Welcome to the Opie Radio Podcast. Looking back in the archives to the best segments and interviews from all incarnations of the show. Shows, it's hard to keep track.
It's Chris Cornell. How you doing, man?
How do you know it's Chris Cornell?
Because I've seen you before.
Oh,
Chris Cornell.
Yeah. One of the greatest singers in rock history.
That's
right
it
there.
I've always said it. I've always said that
we've been
you guys
huge,
one of the best.
We've been huge fans, and that's why we're kind of disappointed. We got to at least acknowledge the fact that we got a lot of equipment set up because we thought you were playing today, and there was a miscommunication somewhere.
We were just talking about that. I don't know how the miscommunication happened, but I'll sing a little bit for you. If I could put time in a bottle, then there's one thing I'd like to do. I'd put some time in the bottle, and then I'd have time in a bottle.
All right.
Thank you.
Wow.
I came through.
Yeah, I don't know how people like somebody says, oh, yeah, Chris will come in and sing. And even I was like, it's kind of early.
Yeah,
for someone to sing. I know how it is to wake up and try to belt something out.
Yeah.
You know, especially with your range and vocal style, it's not really conducive to morning singing.
Not really. I mean, I've done it, but you have to wake up even, you know, a couple hours earlier and sort of kind of take a shower and sing.
Or stay up all night or something.
Well, that's sort of what I'm doing now. I played a show last night and the night before at the Beacon.
So two sold out shows at the Beacon.
Yeah. So I've slept. I've had about an hour of sleep right now. That's why I don't really know where I am.
I'm
singing Jim Croce for you. That's why that's happening.
I like your version better. Just time in a bottle.
Just to get it out of the way, the last time we saw you, you were in Audio Slave. Mm-hmm. You were the lead man for Audio Slave. What happened? Just time to move on?
Yeah. I had a solo career happening, and that's sort of why Audio Slave was able to happen for me. And it was an opportunity that came up. And really from... since Temple of the Dog, I've thought, and I want to keep my mind open to cool collaborative ideas. And it was that. But we did three albums pretty quickly, and I'm very proud of them, love the albums, and then just felt like it was time for me to move on.
Right.
And go back to my own world of kind of doing whatever I want.
I always thought you were your own person. Like, it's hard for you to just stay in a band.
Maybe I got issues. I was thinking about that. Like, I get a little stir crazy. I'm not sure.
Yeah, but you've been successful no matter what you've done, you know, with Soundgarden and then the Temple of the Dog, which, by the way, I'm a huge fan of that album. Huge. I can't get enough of it. I was just jamming Say Hello to Heaven the other day, just singing along to that freaking song, and my vocals are nothing like yours.
Oh, don't sing along to
nothing
that.
Nothing like yours.
What's your favorite song on it?
Say Hello to Heaven.
Say
probably.
Hello to Heaven. Okay,
yeah,
two,
yeah.
Three, go.
No way.
And, oh, you're on.
No way, man.
Yeah, I love when people, you don't understand how that is for a guy that has a range like you, when people go, hey, could you sing that song? Like if you're a singer and people go, hey, sing that Soundgarden song or sing that. You're like, no, you don't understand. It doesn't just come out like that.
Yeah.
That's where the talent part is.
Sometimes when I put the mic, aim the mic toward the audience at the wrong time in certain songs and stuff doesn't come back.
It's not. Hey, Chris, man, we just can't do that. Stop it.
I realize
that.
What are you
doing?
Yeah. If it's like everybody say, yay, they're going to come up with a yay, but certain parts of songs, it might not come back the right way.
Yeah.
But,
the real high part of Sail to Heaven.
Yeah.
He has one of those voices that you actually think you can sing, like Journey. You actually think you can sing that good.
Well, you got to go into falsetto, so you got no power at all.
But you think he's great.
Oh, you're singing like a little girl. Say hello to heaven. Heaven.
That's pretty good.
And knows how to sing.
You can carry a tune.
Anthony knows how to sing. He really does.
I used to have a few bands back in the old days, you know.
You got to hear his Neil Diamond, Chris.
I'll sing Neil all day and all night.
All day.
Don't get me started on the Neil. I heard about, I read something where when you first started singing, you actually tried to figure out where your range was and really couldn't even find it. You just kept trying to go higher and higher.
Well,
you wouldn't crack?
I would sort of want to scream, you know. There are parts of the songs that were written where it's just screaming. That's the part. You know, there's a melody and then there's the screaming part. And to scream, I would just sort of sing above my range and then your voice breaks up and it gets all shrill and it's white noisy. And we were working on a particular song called Heretic that the bass player wrote the lyrics for, and all he could do was scream, really. But then it was decided that I was going to now sing it. So I would scream that part, and one day I kind of went really high to get my voice to break up, and there were like a whole bunch of notes up there. And that's kind of where it started. And then I would come back a couple days later, and there wouldn't be. You know, and so it kind of, you know, some days I could sing the notes, some days I couldn't. And then it was sort of on the job training. We were a band for 3 years before we put out a record. We played a lot. And then we toured, you know, for years before really we started selling records.
That's amazing to me.
We did. I was remembering now, because if I do 3 shows in a row, I'm kind of, you know, that's enough.
A little shot.
I need a day off. And, our Soundgarden, I remember we did 18 shows in a row.
Wow, Christ.
And I'm thinking, like, how did I do that? 18 in a row. If you can do 18 in a row, you can do 365 in a row, I figure.
Yeah, right.
I mean, after
Damn.
About 10.
You wake up in the morning going like, uh-oh, can't do it tonight. No way.
I didn't remember worrying about it too much.
I feel like
what I do now is much better than what I did then, because I, you know, pay a lot more attention to it, you know, and I want to, like... part of it is like people saying, well, this guy's a great singer and he was number whatever on the list of great singers. And over the years, I've thought, well, I got to kind of live up to that. So,
yeah.
You know, I kind of try to make sure I'm in good vocal form. And I don't know, I think back then it was a little more crazy and Soundgarden was so loud that... In some ways, it kind of... If I sang the best I'd ever sang in my life, I'm not sure you would have heard it.
What about... Jesus, what the hell was I just going to ask you?
Well, speaking of Soundgarden, you guys ever...
I hate when that happens.
Would you get back together?
I had a great question.
We do, too.
Yeah. Nah, go screw yourself, Bubby.
Where are you at with Soundgarden? Would you guys ever, like, do a little something-something?
I don't think so.
You're done with them, too?
Well, it's been 10 years now, and I don't... Not once have... I have received a call or heard of anybody wanting to get that going again. So
the fans, man, that's who wants it to get back together.
Yeah, you guys had some great stuff.
Yeah, how long can time go by before it gets silly that you get together again?
I don't know. I think it's so cool to not do it.
To just not do it?
Yeah. It's a way of, especially nowadays with everyone getting back together, it's a way of being cutting edge. Soundgarden can be cutting edge by doing absolutely nothing. There's a sort of a genius in that. We don't have to get up.
Do you do?
They're really ahead of the game, man. They're ahead of everybody.
You do Soundgarden tunes, a couple of them when you play out?
Yeah, I do a lot of different songs.
Yeah.
The band I have out now is like really amazing, and I'm having an incredible time with them. We're doing songs from... I think the oldest one we've done is off of Louder Than Love. And they play great. And then kind of everything from then on. There's a lot of solo songs I did over the years for movies. And then
you do Seasons?
Yeah, we do that.
Oh, God, I love that song.
Anything
from the
I
single
want,
soundtrack.
From the single soundtrack. Anything I want from Soundgarden. We know like about three or four Temple of the Dog songs and... We do a couple Audioslave songs, and then for my 2 solo records, and then I do weird cover songs occasionally.
You do Billie Jean.
I do that, yeah.
I was just hearing about that. I haven't heard it yet, but I hear it's almost unrecognizable. You do
your
own thing.
Yeah, it's very
with it.
Different. It's like a sort of gospel-y. It's actually a heavy song lyrically about a guy who, you know, gets involved with this woman who says this is your kid and it's not his kid. And it's like all we remember really is it's a dance track and he's walking backwards, but it looks like he's walking forward. And I ended up doing that because I had this period in the set where I do acoustic songs, and I just started getting goofy and like trying to pick silly songs or songs you wouldn't expect to play and just kind of freak the audience out. And I thought, who would be really like the last person anyone would ever expect me to cover? And I thought Michael Jackson. But then when I kind of unraveled that song and was reading the lyrics and I changed the time signature and made it sort of gospel-y, it became really kind of heavy.
Yeah.
And then I really liked it. And that's how it ended up on the record. I just thought, you know, it's a good thing to like remind an audience occasionally that, you know, songs and music are really pliable and malleable. And we don't really have, genres don't really exist like we want them to sometimes, you know. You can, like when Johnny Cash did Rusty Cage, I kind of learned a big lesson there.
Did you like it?
I loved it. Yeah. I remember Rick Rubin asking me to do an arrangement of Rusty Cage so that Johnny Cash could record it, and I thought he was out of his mind. And I actually tried like an idiot, and then called him and said that no, I can't do it. And then he didn't do it for that record. He did it for another record, and then I heard it, and of course it went do 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 like every other song, and then the lyrics to Rusty Cage, like, oh, that's how you do that.
How you're doing for Johnny?
Now I get it. But people actually listened to the lyrics when he sang them, and then I would get phone messages from people saying, "Oh, and the lyrics to that song are great." And I would think, "Well, why didn't you say that to me 5 years ago?" Because Johnny Cash wasn't singing them, is why. And we listened to him. Like that a little bit.
You did you write most of the songs that are, you know, known as your songs, popular Soundgarden and.
I wrote a lot of the singles. I wrote, I think, most of the songs we ever made videos for, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Like the Outshine, Black Hole Sun, Fell on Black Days, Spoon Man.
Do you, when you play those now, mm-hmm. do you think like, holy crap, I can't believe I'm still playing this song?
Not really.
No?
And I'm not sure why. I think because there's been breaks in that period.
Yeah, like, true. You're not just out there pumping it out like that the whole time.
And there's so many songs. Like, if you think about it, Soundgarden, especially the last couple records, we could never agree on what songs should go on a record. So we'd go in the studio and record like 16 songs, and we couldn't cut it down to 10 or 12, so we would just put them all on it because that was easier than trying to argue.
Wow.
So the last couple records were really like double albums, and it's just because of the compact disc, we could fit like 78 minutes of music on it, and then when we put them on vinyl, they are actually double albums. So there's a lot of songs, and there are songs I've been doing songs here and there that Soundgarden wrote that we never actually even performed, I don't think.
Yeah, it's probably different for like the Wang Chung guys. I think they're probably like, I can't believe we're still doing Everybody Wang Chung tonight. Or Aha, Take On Me guy.
Right. Kaja Gugu. Yeah.
Are they back together? My goodness.
That
would be a great triple bill.
Oh, hell yeah. Huh?
I remember the movie Live and Die in L.A.?
Yeah.
And Wang Chung wrote the theme song to that.
Yeah.
Called Live and Die in L.A.
And
the video is great because they're not actually sitting with guitars and kind of writing the song. It's all they're all just sort of writing the music, and there's a scene where they're kind of looking at each other. One guy writes a note on the sheet music, and then they high-five each other. That was just the greatest video, 80s rock video moment ever. That's a great note. Give me some skin.
It's so easy back then to make videos.
No kidding,
you just needed a little fire.
Yeah.
and some high-fiving over notes.
Yeah. But as an artist, do you listen to any of your old songs and wish, oh, God, I wish I could redo this? Like, there's a part in it where you just...
Most of it, like, the music and, like, the guitar sounds and what's going on sonically and the parts, I think are, like, better than I remember them. Sometimes I listen to the vocal performances, and that bothers me.
Really?
Not all of it, but sometimes, yeah. Sometimes it sounds like it's somebody else, or like I've got some attitude going in there that has something to do with more than just singing the song. You know, it's like it's not who I am now. And
do you have an example of that?
I would rather do that.
Wow. A song we all know, or
there are parts of like the Louder Than Love record that bother me. I don't really know if I could say what song.
Yeah.
But like something must have been going on. In your head at the time.
Like maybe I'm just sort of forcing it a little bit. Like,
really?
You know, what I can do, I can do it, I can sing it, but it's like there's something going on there where it's like it's acting, I guess is the best way to put it.
Yeah.
And I didn't notice it then, but all these years later, you know, with the experience that I have making records and just trying to be myself with a microphone in front of me, I can hear that little bit of like, okay, here's a kid in there. Screaming his ass off, but there's like something in there that's not, you know, there's something in there that wasn't entirely me that's coming out. Maybe it's tension. I don't know.
There is something about youth mm-hmm. that will just make you do that, like balls out. And
there was a song we wrote, I wrote actually, called Cold Bitch, that ended up being like a B-side for something. And I had it, I got it on my iPod. I took it off of Tom Morello's iPod, and I hadn't heard it in years. And it starts out, and it's very Zeppelin-y, and it's this big sort of cascading riff, and it sounds so great, and I'm just loving it, thinking, God, I wrote this song. And then the vocal comes in, and it's so high. It's like, it's so embarrassing. And I think, that was probably like my masterpiece that never really came to fruition because I was such an idiot. And I thought, okay, I've got this great range. I'm just going to sing way up there. And it's just silly to me. That was probably like 1991 or something.
You would even think like that, like, oh, God, yeah, listen to me. Oh, what an ass.
It comes in, and it's just so bad.
Do you have any, like, stuff from way before you even started seriously playing, maybe with just, like, friends in a garage or a basement that you listened to or would go, like, oh, I couldn't even listen to that. Embarrassing.
I don't know if I have that.
Maybe, like, when you were really younger, like, almost 80s-ish stuff, maybe.
I started out as a drummer, and there are probably some tapes of me playing drums on stuff. Not much, though.
Yeah.
But it wasn't very good, that's for sure.
No.
I do remember that.
No singing, though, with some real hokey, dopey lyrics or something like that?
No.
No, I was always a genius.
Soundgarden was my first band. I mean, there were some
Soundgarden's
songs.
Soundgarden's his first band.
That was my first band where
I
sang.
Oh, you suck!
It's true.
That's great,
otherwise,
man.
It was drumming in, like, bad 80s bar bands. That's why Soundgarden happened, because, like, I ran into two other guys who kind of were having the same experience. Like, wow, if we're going to be in a band that we like, we have to kind of do it ourselves. And that was when I actually picked up guitar and bass and started writing lyrics, because I thought, well, if we're gonna have good songs, we kind of have to do it. We can't wait for somebody else to show up.
Who was in the band when you were the drummer, and like where are they? Do you?
I have no idea. I was in probably 10 bands from 17.
Do you know what
21.
That's like to like be like, dude, Chris Cornell was our drummer.
Yeah, they're still talking about you.
They're still talking about you at a bar somewhere. Saturday night at the bar right. Going, dude, let me tell you, our drummer was Chris Cornell. And they're like, shut up.
Yeah, shut up.
I was the singer, man.
Shut up. It's your turn to get around.
Yeah. you're the top eight on MySpace. Yeah.
Shut up. We're up. It's darts time.
Yeah. I used to have a great way of quitting those bands, too, which is I would say, and very sincerely, I would say, you know what? I just don't think I really am good enough to be in your band.
Oh, that's sweet.
That's a great
feel like you guys are just a little bit behind. Because I was really young, too. Everyone's always older than me.
I'm holding you guys back.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And they would always look at me, you know, thinking, I don't know if this guy's telling us. that was the only way I could do it. But really, as a drummer, I thought I had this romantic idea that if I practiced and worked at it hard enough, some amazing band would just kind of roll through Seattle and go, that guy's so great, we want him to be our drummer. And that didn't happen, at least not in Seattle. I mean, it was just never going to happen.
Yeah.
And Kim and Hiro, the co-founders of Soundgarden, I met. One was the bass player, and one was kind of the fill-in bass player for one of those bad bar bands that I was in. And I met them that way, and neither of them liked the band, and neither did I. But we ended up starting a band together because we decided, well, we're going to have to, you know, figure out a way to be in a good band, and we're going to have to write songs. And if someone else can do it, why can't we do it? And then we spent, like, a couple years writing songs, and we had those, like, initial young band kind of awkward songs that had good parts but were sort of overdone, and some of them were kind of silly, and there's probably some embarrassing stuff in there.
Were you influenced by anything at the time? Because Soundgarden is known to be one of those bands during the grunge period that was like, you know, wow, this is a standout band. Because it was a complete change of music. It went from that 80s hair stuff to the stuff you guys were doing.
Yeah.
Like, what changed that for you? How were you able to take that 80s stuff and completely get it out of your head and get into this new music? It's just so odd to me that...
We were kind of in, or wanting to be, initially, in what was a very healthy U.S. indie record scene at the time, which had bands like Black Flag and Bad Brains and Husker Du and Sonic Youth. And the one wrinkle that we put on it was, and maybe it's because Seattle was always sort of a guitar-based kind of place, we wanted to include 70s rock influences that we liked. You know, riff rock, old school, not necessarily like the 20-minute guitar solos and things like that, but heavy rock that we liked from the 70s, which was not really allowed. Since punk rock, that was sort of not cool. And I think that was a big part of what happened with Seattle, was just a mixture of influences. Like, we took aspects of older arena rock that were good and mixed it with more modern kind of post-punk music. And it just took a few years for people to realize, oh, wait, that's okay. There are elements of 70s rock that are great. And what happened with hair metal was they sort of, like, they would see Led Zeppelin and they would take, like, the kimono and the dove and the light show, and they would forget about, like, the fact that it was the best rhythm section in any rock band ever. They would concentrate on, okay, Robert Plant had a really high range, so they would just find a singer that could sing a high range and forget about how great the riffs were or the melodies or the music. That was all sort of left behind. And I think for us, we just didn't want to completely abandon music that we liked. So we sort of put it in there. And we were not always loved. We were sort of hated for a while.
Really?
Yeah. I remember playing, like, Vancouver, Canada, and like, ashtrays whizzing past my head.
Jesus Christ.
Because that, I always thought of those as good shows, though. We felt like...
Of course.
If that's happening... We're onto something. We know something they don't know, you know.
Yeah, I think that was it, because, like, not being in Seattle at the time and that kind of being the epicenter of what was going on, you guys were ahead of the curve as to what, you know, was going to kind of take off in the country. You kind of saw it building there, and the rest of the country and Vancouver apparently had to kind of catch on.
Yeah, I always thought of it as, like, you know, you got this Whitesnake video with the guy whose model wife or whatever is doing the splits on a variety of Jaguars, right? And it's kind of what hip-hop does sometimes, which is separating the artist from the audience and, like, basically throwing it in your face, like, you ain't gonna be me and you're never gonna have her. And then you see, like, Smells Like Teen Spirit, which is probably a catchier song in the pop world. Mm-hmm. And with youthful aggression, but with three guys, one guy's like 6'9", one guy's like 5'5", and they just look like the same people that you go to high school with. And I think that was the key factor in like this tremendous cultural shift was like, okay, we don't, you know, seeing a video of Motley Crue coming down in the helicopter is kind of cool. But this is cooler, and this is what we've been missing.
Unattainable.
Yeah,
that
exactly.
Was, you know, that was rock and roll, and that it just seemed to happen so quickly too.
Which
it, like,
is proof,
really,
that, yeah. And the fans do that. Record companies don't do that. There is no kind of marketing that can make that happen like that quickly. That was literally like a whole bunch of young rock fans that said, "Oh, this is what we've been wanting."
Being in that atmosphere in Seattle, were you as taken by Smells Like Teen Spirit as the rest of the country was? How that was kind of like, wow, what the hell's going on here?
I remember Ben Shepherd coming into a Soundgarden rehearsal before they had even made that record, and said, "Yeah, I saw Nirvana last night," and he got the name wrong. He said, "They had this song, Smells Like Teenage Spirit. It's amazing. I think it's going to be a huge hit," which is weird hearing him even say that.
Yeah,
and that was probably like 8 months before it was recorded. But it was like that, you know, they would play in front of 100 people. And that was around the time when that talk started happening, like, you know, it's not just an indie scene. This is something that can be like new rock and roll for the masses kind of thing.
And then you got the pissed off fans that were there from the beginning going, "Sell out, man.
Always.
What are you doing, man? Sorry. Yeah. People like us. What can we do?"
Yeah, you liked us, but the other people aren't allowed to?
Yeah. Right.
Is that how it works?
Because everybody kind of wants to think they're a little cooler than everybody else. So if other people start liking you, it's like, wait, I thought I was too cool.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, no one's that cool to like these guys.
Exactly. it happens.
Yeah. We got to get Chris out of here so he can sleep.
Yeah, go to sleep, Chris.
It's Chris Cornell. The solo CD is Carry On. I tracked through it last night. It's awesome.
Thank you.
Very, very cool.
Even though you didn't play, we love having you in. You're a great conversation, man.
Thank you.
Really cool to
Next
talk to
I'll
you.
Next time I'll play, I'll get some other Jim Croce kind of.
Yeah, do that.
What is the Don't Mess Around With Slim? Or
yeah, don't.
What are some of the big hits before he died?
Bad Leroy Brown.
There you go. That was
Superman.
Yeah. You know, he's the baddest man in the whole damn town.
He's actually Superman. Good live. If you see him doing that stuff live, he's great.
Well, oh, really?
He really is. Yeah.
The Opie Radio Podcast.
Chris Cornell, how are you, sir?
There he is. Right.
What's going on, bro?
What's up, Chris?
Hi.
Hanging. It's Jimmy Norton.
Do you hate
Danny?
Do you hate doing this stuff?
No.
Be honest. This is my favorite thing to do.
Yeah.
To be on the radio?
Yeah, especially in the morning live. I'm not kidding. Because you can't actually do this. You can't do this job that you do unless you're good at it.
Well,
this time of day with this many listeners.
It does suck.
You'll get fired.
You're absolutely
you have to be
right.
Good at it.
You know
what
the worst part?
At least be funny, you know.
We're
as long as you're either smart or really funny, you can be a funny idiot. That's great.
Yeah.
Or you can be really smart. That works.
Would you ever do radio or podcasting or any of that stuff?
Not really, no.
You don't want
I just
to
figured
it?
Some type of compelling.
Oh, mine.
You got to be kind of compelling in some way, whether it's funny or an asshole or whatever it is.
Something, yeah.
Yeah, just something.
Exactly.
Just be something.
The hardest part of the job is getting up in the morning and coming in. Once I'm in, I'm like, all right. But when I first wake up, it's just like when I was in construction. I go like, oh, motherfucker, I can't get out of bed. This sucks.
And
then you get up and you're like, okay, now I just get to hang out and talk badmouth people.
I remember my first day of kindergarten.
Really?
Like it was yesterday. And I remember, and the thing was, I remember being woken up before I wanted to be. And I remember thinking, all you guys ever want me to do is be asleep. And now you want me to get up when I don't want to.
And that starts a whole life of having to
exactly.
do that.
Exactly. And I remember it like, and I hated it. I couldn't believe it. And then they just dropped me off at this place. I don't know where it is. And there's other kids. And I didn't, and that was
Dude, how odd was that? Because
it's so not right.
I talk all the time about how I fucking was the biggest crybaby growing up. Like I would cry at the drop of a hat. And when I got dropped off at kindergarten, my mother dropped me off. And then I assumed she was just going to follow me into the classroom.
Mm-hmm.
And I sat there. Like, so she walks
really
me to the door.
Her.
No, it was like this big thing. And I think she knew because she knew my personality at the time. So the kindergarten teacher came out and met me and grabbed my hand and starts walking. And then I look and see my mother walking the other way. I was like, I lost my mind.
She didn't warm you up to this whole
Nothing.
New experience because it goes against everything you were taught as a little fucker.
Yeah,
that you don't leave with strangers
unless you're dropped off by your parents with them
right. yeah.
and abandoned
sold
in a strange
slavery.
Place. Yeah,
were you the kid they had to pick up like 20 minutes later?
No, I wrote it out.
You were able to ride it out.
Wrote it out.
I was the kid where I went over to my friend's house, and by the time my mom got back to our house, which was like a 5-minute ride, she got the phone call to come get me because
really?
I was crying like a little fucking bitch.
Couple of freaking fairies we were.
But I was five.
I didn't have that option. Everybody was five when they got dropped off at kindergarten.
I know, like we were 18.
No, I didn't. Yeah. I was telling a slightly different story, so I didn't want Chris to think that I was 18
I was
crying for mommy.
Everyone was five.
Well, I'm trying to get my 3-year-old to like slowly get into it. And he's not having it. And
really?
So we would go and sort of just sit in the parking lot and watch the kids. And then he'd be kind of like, yeah, I'll go play. I'll go hang out with them. You know, he's almost 3 and a half.
Yeah.
And then, you know, that lasts about literally 4 minutes. And he's like, I want to go home. And I remember it so well. I have vivid memories of being a little kid for some reason. I have, like, a lot of the 90s, I don't remember anything. But
the
age, I remember.
Are
there. So I'm not really pushing him, you know. I'm like, whatever. Well, he's too young anyway. He's just getting used to the idea.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
I hated the institution of school where they put everybody in one place. They judge them by the same criteria, make them do the same stuff. I went to Catholic school, so you have to wear the same clothes. Everything was the same. And that was like, I realized that I hated life then. I didn't know that I would end up doing the job that I do, but it's the perfect job for me.
Yeah.
It's exactly what I should be doing because I hated everything about school and everything about institutions from mostly from the first grade. Kindergarten's cool because you did the cut and paste. There's nap time. you get to play records.
So you're pretty much writing off school after kindergarten.
By first grade, my life sucked. Kindergarten wasn't that bad. You get to bring in like your own records. Everyone brought in kids' records. I brought in the 45 of Hey Jude.
No way, really?
That's my famous kindergarten story. I brought in Hey Jude, and they would not play it.
Wow.
Why?
And I didn't understand. What? I don't know. Maybe because it's long. Maybe because there was some screaming. Because it wasn't a little kid record.
I didn't have a xylophone in it.
Exactly. I didn't know what little kid records were.
My kindergarten memories are from fucking being yelled at from Mrs. Slavic, from picking my nose and eating it, and for making other students listening to Teddy Clouser go to the bathroom. I'll be like, look, he's going to the bathroom. We'd all put our ears against the bathroom door and giggle.
You were a deviant even back then.
Scolded.
Yeah, you were bad.
That's why kids like me hated fucking school. Tortured.
Did you make it all the way through the 12 years, or did you say
No, at some point? 7th grade was the last year I finished.
Yeah.
And then I went to 8th grade sort of a couple times.
Wait, over a couple years.
How
do you get away with like dropping out of school in 7th grade?
Well, I went to 8th grade and didn't finish.
But did your parents, were your
parents? I left home, kind of, and then I tried 8th grade again the following year. And I was sort of started school a year early, so like psychologically, I could talk myself into it's being it's not so hard on my ego. Like right. I'm not an idiot. I started a year early. Then the second attempt at 8th grade didn't go that well.
Jesus.
And
where were you living if you left home?
I was living with my grandparents, who I could pretty much run the show. They're old enough where it was pretty easy. I became like Kreskin with my grandparents. Pretty much anything could appear and disappear at any time. And they're on lots of medication, so I would take their prescription Benadryl and take it to school and trade it for real drugs and stuff like that. I was running the show.
Yeah.
And once you get a taste of that, even if it's 13, you kind of are going to run the show after that.
The same thing happened because I went a little further. I think I went to like 11th grade and then I was fucking up so bad, mm-hmm. and the dean of boys, whatever it is, told me, look, why don't you just take the year off and come back next year and, do whatever you want to do, but come back and finish next year. Because you can't. He goes, there's no way you're passing this year. I go, okay. So I went out and I worked, and I'm making money. I had fucking money for cigarettes and a little whiskey in the Jack Daniels in the woods with my friends, on the weekends and
you
shit.
You get a taste of that. There's
and
no
then,
way
yeah,
you're
I
back
went
to
back
school.
To school, and I'm like, great. Now I'm fucking broke again. I got people telling me what to do. So I just said, screw it. And
once you get a job, because that happened to me. I started working full time, I think before you're even legally supposed to.
Yeah.
And then I could pay for everything. I didn't have to take anybody's crap. And but that, obviously, at some point in my life, I wished that I would have finished school.
Yeah, don't you? You kind of, it hits you at one point. You're like, I would have liked to have been a fighter pilot.
Well,
I wanted to be an astronaut.
I actually write for a living, writing song lyrics, and I can barely spell my own name. So that's been a problem.
But it's kind of like, it's you were kind of right to not like the institution because, I didn't graduate high school either. And it's like, not that you don't need that if you want to be a doctor or a lawyer, but you've made a great living being creative.
That's true.
And despite what they would have taught you, what they would have taught you would have meant nothing.
Yeah, I think there are things about it that would have been helpful. But I'm also I'm sitting on the other side of it as a successful musician, whereas I could have easily been sitting on this side of it as a non-successful musician with no education. So it's hard enough to get a job. There are a lot of very educated people that can't get jobs now. So you don't want to be on the list of the guy that doesn't have.
No, you realize the element of luck that's involved also in getting to where you are. If you're lucky enough to do radio or be a musician that's successful and shit.
Yeah, it's rare.
For the most part, you're just some guy that's working a shit job because you didn't finish high school.
Let me ask you this: now that you're a parent, if your kid came to you and said, "I'm dropping out,"
I would say, "You see that tree out in the backyard? I want you to go break off the longest, thinnest branch and bring it straight to me."
You'd want him to at least try to give school a shot, right?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there are a couple of ways to look at it. One of the things is it's a little bit like you're dean of students in a way. It's sort of like they kind of make you feel like you have to graduate in the same time frame as everybody else, and you're judged by the same criteria. I think,
I encourage the educational part of it, and the time frame part of it. I don't know that I would necessarily push as much. I don't think any kid really belongs two grades behind in school. But in terms of like going into college or getting more education, I don't think, you know, it has to happen within a very specific amount of time. I could go to college now.
Yeah,
no one taught me that.
Right.
I didn't know that. I thought if you don't graduate high school by 18, you're
you
going to live under a bridge
shot.
For the rest of your life, yeah. And that's that.
You only have one shot.
Yeah,
that's a great point. Yeah,
but
there is
true.
A lot of pressure on people to graduate and get right into college.
Yeah.
Get the whole life thing started. You know, on the right track, and it is kind of bullshit because people they progress at different speeds. So why, you know, shove somebody into college if they're not ready for it?
Exactly. And especially with the attention span part of it, because I feel like right now at this point in my life, I could take any course and learn anything and be totally focused on it, and it's no problem. I have no distractions. I was super ADD in high school. Like, you know, that's why I never really finished anything. I would just find myself staring out the window and wanting to do other stuff.
Yeah.
And then
drawing.
Over time, I kind of that changed.
Didn't you find, though, that by being a dropout, like, I kind of figured, like, I if I don't make it, I got nothing. Like, it kind of made me,
yeah,
I left no safety net.
That's
I'm
true.
Like, I either get where I'm going to go, or yeah, I am fucking in
that
deep
is
trouble.
That's true, yeah.
You is kinda... that, is that, did everyone in this room drop out?
Yeah, we're all
fools. The only one.
<That's incredible.
laughs> I know, we're terrible. We're all a bunch of dropouts.
Yeah, a room full of millionaires and me.
Jimmy's got to be doing all right by now,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, Jimmy's all right.
Oh, God. Musically, I wanted to ask you about the James Bond theme.
Uh-huh.
Like, did you think that was just another gig or something, or was it
at
was
first,
it cool
yeah
to you? Like, oh, that's kind of, you know, because there have been some really good James Bond songs and some really shitty ones.
Yeah,
and it kind of does put you in the position where the song is judged.
Yeah,
separate from the movie.
It's true.
It's part of the movie.
It's
but
true.
It's like, wow, if you put out a shitty Bond song, you're like Madonna. She put out one and it
yeah
was terrible, and she caught a bunch of shit for it. But
hers,
I got to tell you,
hers wasn't really a Bond song. And I know this, the inside
right
information.
Yep.
It was just it was like a song that didn't make her last record.
Yeah.
And so that she just changed the word, put the title of the movie into the song.
There's a sound to a good Bond song that, and it's,
right,
I can't put my finger on it, but you know it's a fucking Bond song.
Exactly.
And yours was one of the best, and I'm not just kissing your ass, it was one of the best Bond songs I ever heard. I actually downloaded it and have it on my iPod as just a fucking great song.
Cool.
Yeah. It really, like, it's a good song. Did you,
mm-hmm,
you co-wrote it?
I wrote most of it.
Most
yeah
of it, yeah.
I actually wrote an entire one, and then I was working with David Arnold, who does the score for all the Bond films. And he'd kind of wanted me to get involved with him in writing it so that musically we could use the basic melody as a recurring theme,
yeah,
throughout
which was,
the score.
Which was cool. It went through the whole movie.
You know, the melodies that I came up with, he did do that with. But I had a whole song finished, and I played for him. And there are parts of it I didn't really like, and he really didn't like the same parts I didn't like. And so I thought, you know what, I'm gonna let this guy in, and we'll do this together. And no one made me do it. I liked him. David Arnold's a brilliant guy. He's a genius musician. And we just kind of finished it together. We produced it together, played all the instruments, except, of course, the orchestra. We didn't.
Yeah, the orchestra.
We weren't running around doing that.
Like, we played the orchestra.
Yeah. Yeah. Oboe, right? How do you play it? Let's do this. But the funny thing is that they told me, we don't want this to really sound like any other James Bond song. And you can do anything you want because we got this new guy, and I already knew who he was, and I'd seen part of the movie. I knew it was going to be great, and they said, "So do whatever you want." And so I sort of went out of my way to try to write a song that wouldn't sound like a James Bond theme, and then it totally ended up sounding like that, which I think is really great. I got lucky, but I kind of looked at it like "Live and Let Die." When I was a little kid, and I heard "Live and Let Die," I didn't know that it had anything to do with a movie. I just thought it was an amazing song.
It was a
song.
Cool song.
It's
right,
one of the
exactly
best Paul McCartney songs solo
you
ever.
Really do
yeah
forget.
Yeah.
But
yeah
did he write that for Bond?
Yes.
Yeah.
For the movie
yeah
"Live and Let
you
Die."
You just forget
yeah
that. Yeah.
I didn't know because yeah you know my parents didn't take me to the theater to see Bond movies when
right
I was 10. So, but yeah, it was the song, you know, it lived independently of the film.
Yeah.
The film lived independently of the song, but they worked together.
I was an idiot though at first when I first got the call and they said, you know, they want you to do a song for the James Bond movie. Me being American, I didn't understand what that meant. I thought, because I have lots of songs in lots of movies where they're just kind of in there. And I thought, oh, okay, you know, that's whatever.
Sure. Yeah. No, it's like, no, this is like a big thing for James Bond movies.
And I didn't get it until I got on the phone and I talked to the people that you talk to and I said, I'm not going to get in a songwriting contest. I'm gonna, so if you want me to do it, I'll do it. If you don't, no, but it's not going to be, you know, you're going to wait. I'm not going to do all this work and then have you, have it be part of a list of songs and then choose. You either choose me and I'll do it and I'll make sure it's great or go to hell. And they're like, no, we want you. And then I still was kind of not getting it. And then I started doing interviews and it started by phone and I was at home and they're like, so tell me, how does it feel to have been chosen to the next James Bond? You must be 10 feet above your chair. And I'm like, wow. And I kind of had to make it up, like, sort of, you know, it's really amazing. I guess Americans don't really get this, do they? And then I did this press junket, and it was like that. People from all over the world, like, weeping about the next Bond thing.
Nice. And then, pressure, though, man. Like, they're already saying, like, really? How amazing this is.
Oh, yeah.
Write a great one, and you're like, on great works, so usually you kind of stumble on
it's
them.
It's been like Goldfinger was a song years ago that got very popular on the radio because of Goldfinger and stuff. So Bond songs are either hit or miss. Duran Duran.
They had a huge, they were the last one that really had a big hit. And there was a bunch of them that, there was the one with the dance into the fire, that one. Isn't that it?
Was the spy who loved
kill.
Me?
View to a Kill.
I had to get to the cars in my head. Yeah. View to a Kill was there.
They did a great job with that.
Which was another really good really Bond good. Song for the time, especially.
For
you
the
know,
time, it was a big hit. And I think that was like the last one that was like a
that was a big one.
Hit.
You know what was good with your song was the way, and you were saying it earlier, the orchestra used it throughout the entire movie. So you'd have like a mysterious part of the movie, and you'd hear the melody of that song, but done in this very moody kind of thick, mysterious way. And then an action sequence would have part of the song on it, too. So
that
to
was
have
all,
it run through the movie like that was very cool.
And that worked out really well. And that was, you know, I hats off to David Arnold for just putting it out there because he didn't know me. And we met and he just kind of said, you know, I'd really like to work with you on this if you'd like. I know you don't have to. And, you know, he didn't know who I was or what I was going to be like.
How'd you get picked? Like who? Someone?
I think it was a few people. I think a woman named Leah Volokh who does music for films. You know, she sort of finds people for the right song and the right person to do the movie. David Arnold, I think, helped.
Were they like fans that just kind of go like,
woman
yeah, I like
Jody Gerson, who's been worked with a publishing company of mine for years, helped. It's their job and their fans, you know. And I think the main thing was Daniel Craig got me the job because they get Daniel Craig and they've got this guy. It's like, now we're going to have this new James Bond who doesn't take any shit. And he does all his own stunts and he doesn't do anything that a human being can't do. And it's based on the first Bond book, so the first book that Bond is in, so it's sort of more of a tangible story. So now we need to get like an unapologetically male singer. That was their criteria, and then my name came up.
cool.
So I, you know, it's like let's get a guy who's a guy, and he'll sing it like a guy, and he's not, and it'll be okay, and no one's gonna get mad at that. And that's how I got the job.
Hey, did you submit it and go like this is it, or do they have a part of the creative process? Were you like this is the song, or they go hey we like it? But
I played a demo for David and then we demoed the song together. We did a second demo and gave it to them, and they're like, we love it, and that
that's
was
great
it. Yeah,
and there perfect it is. Perfect.
And they also said, you know, this doesn't usually happen this easily, and I said, well, for me this is how I like things to go. I don't like the rewrites. I've never scrapped an album and then gone and re-recorded it, or you know, I'll try to make sure it's, you know, what I want at the time.
One take, cut, print, perfect.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
A man his size would have trouble writing a James Bond theme song.
I love that fucking movie.
Stupid George Animal Steel walking to the wall. Fucking Tor Johnson.
Damn. Audioslave. Now, when you're working with Audioslave, you would come into one of the other studios we were at before. We were, you know, summarily thrown out, I guess.
Kicked out of there.
As it happens.
It had less security there, though.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah, here it's like...
You seem more important here.
Yeah, we seem more important. That's good. It's good illusion because it certainly is not the
shit.
Certainly isn't the
shit. What happened with Audioslave? It was just time to move on.
Yeah, we did.
I mean, we don't have to get too crazy.
We did a lot. We made three albums in a really short period of time.
Got to play Cuba.
We got to play Cuba. Our third album, I think, was kind of our best, really, in terms of, I think we finally sort of defined who we were as a band. The first couple, we were sort of, you know, going in two different directions.
That had to be rough.
And it was great. I mean, even the first album, I love the songs. I love all the records. The third album, I think, sounds the best by far. Mm-hmm. But I also think it sort of has more of a cohesive sound in terms of the songwriting. And that was the time when, for me, I think, two things were happening. One was there's a whole bunch of business stuff that we never really dealt with that was really kind of tangled from the beginning because it was two separate entities. And it was time to deal with that. We weren't really agreeing on that stuff that much. And the other thing was that we were at a stage where musically we were going to have to sort of reinvent who we were and how we did it. Like Soundgarden did, going from Bad Motorfinger to Super Unknown. Mm-hmm. By Bad Motorfinger, we had been a band for 8 or so years. It just, only indie people had heard of us. So that was the first album where people really heard of us, but we had defined ourselves on that album. It was time to move on. And it was difficult, you know, to reinvent your band and who you are and the way you write musically, and we did that. And I saw that as being something I'd done before and thought, you know, if I'm going to go into, you know, if I'm going to dig that deep, I think I'd rather just sort of go back to being a solo guy.
Mm-hmm. You guys had creative, like, artistically? It's got to be hard with a bunch of, like, because I know, was it too political for you or not political enough, or did that get in the way of it at all?
No, in the very beginning, that was an issue, and we got over that pretty quickly.
Yeah, it seemed like you guys did.
Because I quit.
before, I said, fuck that.
Before the first record came out. But no, that,
you didn't want it to be as political as it was?
Well, I didn't want to. I have no problem with somebody deciding to make that their focus of their art, but not. I'm not like that. That's just not natural for me. It would be just a stupid record. You know, I write songs like that that come out. They come out when they come out, and I don't. I can't force it. It just happens or it doesn't happen.
Right. There's no agenda behind it or motive. Just whatever you feel creatively as an artist.
Exactly. I mean, even on the newest record, it's produced by Timbaland. There are a couple songs on there that have sort of social political themes that just kind of came out. Because they did.
But you didn't go into it going, man, I'm gonna take on the establishment, man.
Yeah, and it's also, I didn't, you know, and I'm not making any judgments here or anything either, but like when you sign a record deal with Sony International, and what songs are you gonna really sing and still sort of feel like that all kind of makes sense?
You know something? I've always thought that. It's like you're working for the man.
Yeah, and it's
who are you bashing?
It's a weird thing, and I've had that issue. That was a big Seattle problem. There was and it was a problem, I think, with Audioslave as well, and probably a problem with Rage Against the Machine, which Morello referred to as the punk rock guilt, which is, you know, we came from the punk rock school of things, which was anti-establishment and anti-corporate. But at some point, you're like thinking, here we are doing all of this. We're working our asses off, writing all these songs, making these records. We want as many people as we can to hear them. Why shouldn't we be Led Zeppelin? Why shouldn't we have as many people listen to our songs as them? There's no reason not to. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, at least four bands out of Seattle have multi-platinum success, and everyone's sort of looking at each other trying to pretend like, you know, we're still, you know, in the garage, and it's not the case,
right,
you know?
Yeah.
And everyone's real careful with what kind of cars they're driving, because they don't want to... It's like, I know how much money you make, so if you're driving the Toyota, it doesn't, God, you're not damn fooling anybody.
You're only
but we
really
struggled with it. Everybody yeah struggled with it. And the
punk
and
guilt. That's
yeah, you saw
hysterical,
it.
Man.
It came up a lot.
Because yeah a lot, because if material success or selling a lot of albums or becoming more and more famous doesn't mean that as artists you've sold out. It just means that you've connected with a lot of people and that there's a message you're giving which a lot of people like.
But
so there's nothing to be ashamed of in that.
It does change your outlook on things where when you spend all those years writing that first album, and now you're successful and have to come up with that second album. First of all, you spent, you know, you could have been 15 when you started writing yeah your first album.
Yeah.
And you have all this emotion and stuff, and the album's great. Now you got, what, a year to yeah come up with the next one.
Not even a year. And, I mean, back yeah in the day, it was like if you made an album and it took you 5 years and you got a record deal and they put it out and suddenly it's the biggest thing since sliced bread. You got like 2 months.
Yeah, put out
they're
it now.
After
now
you
do it
let's
again.
Go.
It's
let's
like,
go.
Wait, that was my whole life.
Yeah, yeah.
That's why. And now I got to come up with a whole new like life. But again, your outlook gets different. Even though you want to keep thinking the way you were thinking and stuff, just the thing of oh, okay, I need a corporate name. I need to make a corporation, and yeah I gotta sign forms from a lawyer and do that. Your outlook on things change. You're not the same.
Yeah, you have to be aware of a lot more.
Yeah,
things.
you got to kind of keep an eye on things and an eye on people, and it changes your outlook.
Is
so
it hard when you're going
to
fuck
different
society, and then society goes, "But we love you. Yeah, we think you're terrific."
For Soundgarden, that was a crisis actually for us, a legitimate one, which was we were used to having to prove ourselves everywhere we went because we were an indie band for a long time. We'd go to the club in Houston and the club in New Orleans and you play and first in front of like the bartender and the janitor and some cross-dresser and then the second time through there'd be about 40 people who and some of them wouldn't have your first record and then the third time through it would start to get kind of full and you know you'd go on and like that sort of slowly but surely and it's a long process and at some point you get this it's us against the world and then all of a sudden you're playing a hockey arena and everyone's there to love you. We didn't really know how to deal with that.
Yeah,
we were it's like us against you kind of thing, and now it's like now you're singing our songs and you love us, and we didn't really know how to deal with that, and it we didn't know how to be who we were, how we had learned to be, and mm-hmm and share the love. Now I have as a solo artist, I have the opposite thing.
You know, it's
the first Audioslave show was really weird because I remember sort of approaching Tom on stage and approaching Tim on stage and, you know, smiling and seeing like these stern sort of looks, frowns back at me just because they'd never done that before. That wasn't part of the program.
We're not having a good time. We hate this.
It's like, why are you frowning? There's a private plane outside.
And that changed. Like, everybody loosened up and we, you know, started to have a good time. But for me now, it's kind of like I enjoy that the audience likes my songs and,
you know,
and
it's different
have
though
a great
about,
time.
The different thing about Soundgarden, though, was you guys never came off as a real, like, bitter, angry, where every lyric of every song was about how establishment sucks and stuff. And it's like what you said before.
No,
if it came out that way. So when you had so many fans starting to just love the music, it didn't come off like, you know, oh, fuck, you know, these guys are... they're world haters and shit. And,
right.
And it just came off as
we
great
never had
music
a backlash at,
right,
of any kind.
Rage is different in that every song they wrote was, wait a minute, he's pretty much singing that he wants me dead. you know, I love the music.
But I love this. Yeah. I love this band.
So that came across as almost hypocritical uh-huh on their part that they embraced the corporation and the money that they were making and everything, but yet on stage
singing against all that,
it's kind of like, all right, I get it, I enjoy it, but don't try to tell me that you're really
right
into this
right
and, you know, tooth and nail, you're actually going down Rodeo right
with
a shotgun. You know.
Yeah. Well, I think that that's something that's like a monster you build and then you have to struggle mm-hmm with it. Like, I know only personally know about what Tom does, and Tom does spend a large part of his life giving back. He has a thing called Axis of Justice, and he's extremely involved in helping out different people from different demographics that need help from people like him because nobody else cares, and he definitely walks the walk, and I always said that about him. But at the same time,
you know, you're still having to kind of be in bed with with big scary companies.
You're shaking hands with certain people that you're like, ugh, I know you're a scumbag.
Yeah, and you know, I guess there's a certain amount of beauty of the fact that a large part of that industry is sort of dying off, and the scumbags don't really have a place in the world anymore, and at least in the music business.
And
which is good,
yeah,
because the downloads, right? The record companies are getting cut out a lot of
digital media.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think you're going to see like a resurgence of mom and pop record stores because people are always going to want CDs and LPs, and all of the big stores that put those places out of business or made them struggle are going out of business because they can't sell the volume that they need to sell in order to stay open.
No, you watch these huge mega stores, just they're all gone.
Yeah. I like that point, though, mom and pop stores.
I got to disagree, though. I don't think it's going to happen. Because
nothing better than mom and pop stores, just walking around and going downstairs to the basement record store and checking out shit.
For us, because we grew up like that, but people who haven't bought a CD, like there's 17-year-olds, I think 40% of them didn't buy a CD. For them, music is automatically just taken offline. They never
understand
hold anything.
Whatsoever.
Yeah, they would have no desire to do that.
I gotta ask because everyone's asking. Soundgarden, would you ever get the boys back together for something?
We've never really talked about doing that. So
when it was done,
you never know. Yeah, because you never do know. Anything can happen.
Yeah. Does it bother you? I'm sorry, man. I was saying, I saw the Trent Reznor badmouth, and I'm like, as an artist, as a radio show, we get like if someone another radio show attacks us, it's like doubly fucking aggravating.
Does that happen to you?
Yes,
really? Right.
Oh,
I
know
it happened. I mean,
yeah,
I know there's radio wars, sort
Radio's
of,
a
but
circus.
You guys,
no,
it's bad.
Oh, yeah. They get really bad sometimes.
So really?
Oh, yeah. Wow.
But it's like we get angrier at another radio show than we would at somebody who's not, and it's like, and then Trent Reznor, who I don't know if you're friends with him or not. I always thought he was kind of a jizz bucket. That's just my take on him.
Wow.
I never really liked him.
Jizz bucket.
That's just my take on him. Fuck him.
Right.
Never liked him. We get it.
You never liked Nine Inch Nails?
Never. But he's shitting on your new thing. It's like, for what?
Yeah, I don't know. I never met him. Soundgarden was, we were a fan of his, especially his video, but his video and had like a whole
like
song.
Yeah, yeah. It's very
I heard that.
Creepy.
I loved that. We hired the same guys that did that video to do the Jesus Christ Pose video based on that. And then, you know, that was kind of it for me as far as being a fan, but I liked that. I never met him. I never read what he said about my Timbaland record. Making a record with Timbaland and me being me, I knew there was going to be people that were going to talk shit. That's sort of, that's like a script someone wrote for you.
It's kind of not fair because what Chris does a lot is you try to come up with new sounds and stuff. You're brave enough to try different things.
Well, I have a lot of musical influences that can't really get completely exercised in certain formats. And like on the Timbaland album, I was like huge into late 60s, early 70s R&B, funk rock, soul music. And like I got to do a lot of that on this album that, you know, I'll never be able to do like that again. I was never really able to authentically do it before. And now I get to go take that out live. I'll always get to take that out live. Mm-hmm. And it's great. I love playing the songs live. They go over great live.
Awesome.
So for me, it's been a huge success. But like he said something that's like on Twitter, which is like you can basically put one paragraph. I added him so I can see what he says, you know. he doesn't like bring it up anymore. I think he said one little thing and then it was sort of repeated over and over and over.
Sort of just like a mental kind of a here, I'm just gonna blurt this shit out and then leave it alone.
But what I do see is he does talk about Star Trek a lot. which is, you know, he's got opinions about a lot of stuff. But he talks about Star Trek a lot.
Wow.
And that, I don't know what tale that tells, but it tells some kind of a tale.
A fucking nerd.
There is a group that talks about Star Trek, and maybe he gets a little preoccupied with it. And in fact, I see it on the cover of the magazine here.
Yeah.
The new Star Trek movie is out. He was talking to people about that. I think everybody's happy about it.
Five stars.
Yeah, five stars in the paper.
Yeah, in the paper.
You know, I don't like Trent Reznor because years ago I dated a girl named Liz who had a thing for him, and she goes, you know, he's bisexual. And she said she masturbated thinking about me and him fucking.
Jesus Christ, Jimmy.
And it always annoyed me from then. I was like,
and that was it.
Yeah, because she thought he was like really deep, and I was like,
all right, now at least we know that why.
Yeah, that's why I kind of disliked
him. As far as you brought up the videos just before, when you look back at 90s videos, did you realize at the time that they would have such a distinct look to them? Because they do. When you look back at like Nirvana videos and Nine Inch Nail videos, your guys, it had this weird blurry, fuzzy background edge thing and old people's faces close up kind of.
You know why?
And they started using it in commercials for like neosinephrine.
You know why? Because it's the same guy that directed all of those videos, or the same two guys who started out as partners, and then it's those same guys that directed the commercials.
Really?
Yeah, it's the same handful of people.
I wondered, because I started seeing commercials that looked like the videos, and I'm like, that's it, these videos are done.
That's when you know you're in trouble.
Yeah, it's the same guys. It was like two guys. And I got in a, like a big fight with one of them, because he did one of our videos, and he made it so smoky that you couldn't see who we were. And it was the first time MTV had terrible. Guaranteed we were going to get heavy rotation. So it was like, okay, so we want to show people who we are. And the whole time we're filming, I'm sort of yelling like, you know, there's smoke everywhere. And he's like, no, don't worry. It won't show up on camera. And like, what do I know? I'm not a filmmaker. I don't know what's going to show up on camera and what isn't. And we get the first cut. You can't see anything, you know.
Your spinal tap moment.
Yeah, and the same guy was doing the that 17-minute long Metallica video with the old man's face.
Right, the old
man's
face.
And so he wouldn't clean up the edit, so we had to reshoot it. And then two months later, he sends us a new edit he does just to piss me off, where actually he did do it where you can't see any of the smoke and you can see all of our faces. And we never used that video, but I didn't like most of them anyway.
What about Black Hole Sun, which was a very
That video.
Popular one. That video is weird, really creepy if you looked at it.
That video was Howard Greenlaw, and that was us like basically saying, look, we keep trying to sort of come up with all these images and these ideas, and we can't find directors who will do it right. So let's just pick a guy that has a good idea, and we're just going to show up and pretend to play like you're supposed to, and let the guy do his thing. And that's what we did with Black Hole Sun.
That was cool because it was kind of the first real public display of morphing.
Yeah,
I think really. And
I remember him telling
out.
Us. Yeah, he's British, and he was like telling us, when you get the final version, it's going to be weirder than this. The first one was really weird anyway.
Yeah,
so it didn't matter.
But then the first time I saw it, and you saw someone smile, and then their mouth got really strange. I was like, hey, this video is scaring me.
Exactly.
Was that before Michael Jackson's Black and White?
I think I don't know.
And it was different. It was like that was a morph, kind of a face to face change morph video. This was a face where all of a sudden the eyes would get like distorting and disturbingly big, and the nose would twist and the smile was
it
weird.
All worked.
It's a freaky video.
Absolutely.
Man.
That's
really
another
cool
thing that I saw in commercials. To this day, I see that video being ripped off in commercials. That same sort of like over the top kind of post-war perfect suburbia that gets twisted into some weird perversion.
Yeah, or it's usually for some dog food commercial where the dog goes, what? And their eyes get really big because he's getting a schnozzage or something. they're saying Chris has
to leave.
That sucks, man.
Well, I got the flu, so I got
it. That's all right. We all do, too.
The swine flu?
Don't worry about it.
It's the say it's the swine flu. I don't know what that means. It's I ate too much pork. Too many club sandwiches.
That's nicer than the way I got it.
The CD's called Scream. They're saying it's in stores now. I mean,
Chris
it's in stores.
Just download the damn thing, will you?
Chris is doing Letterman this Friday. Years,
what man. Stores? Yeah. There are no stores.
Wait, you're doing Letterman?
I did Letterman last night, but it's going to be aired Friday.
You're on with our pal Brian Regan, who was in here
comedian,
yesterday.
Yeah.
Wow, that's going to be a great Letterman. You got Chris Cornell singing, and you got Brian
Watch
Regan.
Watch for the end, because he comes up, Letterman comes up behind after we're done with the song, and I don't know where he is. I can hear his voice. And I turn around and I hit his hand with the headstock of my guitar and on his knuckle. And I know what that feels like because it's obviously happened to me.
Yeah.
And I hit the shit out of his hand. and it was by accident. And he's really, he's a total pro. He's like, he did that thing where he kind of goes, ow, that kind of hurts. And you know that pause that you get when you hit your knuckle? You know it hurts, but it hasn't really kicked in yet.
It's going to hurt.
He goes, ow, that kind of hurts. And then he goes up to the address the camera, and then the pain kicked in, and I can see it.
and he see looks, this now.
He kind of looked back at me over his shoulder like, you motherfucker. That you just really, it's my show, and you really just fucking cracked my knuckle.
How funny if tonight Letterman has a cast on his hand.
That would rule.
He was very cool about it, but it was. Watch for that. I hope it shows up on camera.
Well, Chris, a pleasure as always. We love when you come in.
Yeah,
man.
I'm a huge fan of your
work. We're all
your
huge
fans. Definitely.
I want to get into Mother Love Bone stuff, but next time.
Next time, anytime you're in town, you want to promote anything or whatever, stop by, definitely.
The Opie Radio Podcast.
Chris, I got to start. Earlier in the show, we played The Keeper before you got here.
That's excellent.
And fucking love the song.
Thank you.
Me and Ann always talk about when you slow it down, you have just the most amazing voice.
Thank you.
And it's good to hear that.
Yeah, there's like, two things there. You could either get the holy shit Chris Cornell, like really fucking getting the range and screaming and sounding amazing. But you could take it down and do a real soft song that... It's just
really shows off your voice too, man.
Touching, quite touching.
I think there's a compliment in there somewhere.
Somewhere,
It was a little weird,
there's
right?
Confusion in there too.
I know,
it's not, but
I
it's
know.
Not your fault.
I don't know what I'm saying.
It's something that I have done.
I saw Soundgarden
in my life. That nobody really knows. It doesn't make a lot of sense, but I don't know. I just like music, so whatever I like, I want to kind of go do sometimes. So,
do you like Johnny Cash's cover? I mean, I love his cover of Rusty Cage. When you first heard that, did you like that?
Yeah, I did.
You did.
It baffled me a little the concept, but I learned a lot, which was you can take any song and kind of do whatever you want with it, and if it's a good song, it'll work out. He just took Rusty Cage, a Soundgarden song, which was this crazy against the wall riff, and then just rearranged it so it went dum 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 dum, and then he sang Rusty Cage over it. It was Johnny Cash. It was great.
And then you're like, he went dum 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 dum. It's like, wow, which is really a stretch for Johnny Cash.
Did Johnny Cash thing. But he turned me on to the song from Soundgarden. Like, I heard Johnny Cash's first.
Oh, really?
And then he got into Soundgarden.
Really?
Yes.
That's an odd thing.
I'm very anal about rock. I listen to Sabbath and Kiss. I feel disloyal if I like anything else.
Really?
I'm a complete creep.
He's obsessed with Sabbath.
True.
Yeah, I'm stuck in the 70s.
But I, I got messages from people after Johnny Cash did Rusty Cage, telling me that how great the lyrics were, and they never said that when they heard my version. It was Johnny Cash. Sort of, I think you listen to him more, and he sold those words more than I did somehow.
I wonder why that is.
I don't know, but even when I met him one time, and it was terrifying. It's the only time I've really been scared to talk to another human being. And when he spoke, like, the ground vibrated around you a little bit because his voice was really low, and he was just a super intense guy. But some people have that ability when they sing. You stop and pay attention to what they're saying.
How is it out with Soundgarden? Everything fine?
Great.
Yeah.
We had a blast.
I went to the Jersey show. Fucking amazing.
Thank you. It's fun. It's really fun.
Really loud still, man.
Yeah.
really loud still.
That's good, though. Because sometimes you see bands, when they get back together again, and it's like, fuck, man, I remember this when it was loud.
Oh, they like to keep
it loud.
And
now I can talk to the person next to me.
Yeah. No, it's not like that.
Yeah. No.
You're not having conversations when you go to a Soundgarden show.
That would be weird, almost, I think, if you could hear anybody speak. That happens sometimes.
It sucked. I went to see, years ago, I went to see Blue Oyster Cult when they got back together. And I was able to lean over to my friend and go, yeah, this is ME-262. I'm glad they're doing this one. And you're like, you never would have, your nose would have bled.
Turn that shit up, right?
Yeah, it was crazy.
Yeah.
That's what I like, though. Still, Soundgarden, you're going to hear the volume. The guys are all into it and shit, right?
Yeah. We're all having a great time. We tried to actually, in the interest of not murdering our ears and getting tinnitus, and we tried to back off the volume a little bit this time. We were talking, we're rehearsing a lower volume, try that out. And just everybody sort of reaches and turns up slowly at different times across the stage, and then that starts playing louder. And at some point,
usually you see the first person you usually see is the guitarist to go over and go like, doo, doo, doo,
just a
touch
bit.
To get his lead up a little bit, and then the bass player is like, well, bottom end is gone. Let me go up here, and then the drummer's fucking just pounded to try to play a little louder, and Chris is screaming.
Yeah, and after 10, a little bit, it's
before you know it. Yeah,
it's insane.
Are your ears shot?
Supposed to be.
No, my ears are pretty good, but after some of these shows in the summer, I definitely was hearing bells. And
you don't do the plugs?
No. So I do in ears sometimes, but I don't,
Okay.
No.
Yeah.
You don't hear that whoosh.
Yeah, I hear that.
That whistly sound, man.
Or sometimes just that in the middle of the night wakes me up. It goes away.
Do you have to? In a while it does. Do you have to go to sleep with like something on, like a TV or?
Thank God. I hope that doesn't happen. I have friends that do that.
Yeah, it's like you just because you
have to have a fan or something.
Yes, you know. Something. Someone in the room telling you rule. Oh, idiot I am.
That was all right though. Man.
Oh, that stunk.
No, it was kind of cute.
What's the solo tour all about? What are we going to hear?
I don't know. I usually don't do set lists for that.
Oh, you just
like whatever I want from any.
You just kind of make it up as you go.
Yeah.
You never get somebody yelling, do Stonehenge
from the fucking crowd. Yeah, I do. Yeah. If you yell it, I'll probably try it.
Give it a whirl.
That's sort of part of what's fun about it. Because with a band, especially a loud band, it's hard to communicate. And, you know, let's do this song because someone brought a sign, that kind of thing.
Right.
Like, when I'm alone, I can just do it.
What songs have you tried?
Songs that I haven't ever really tried to play acoustically, I've tried before. I remember someone yelled at 4th of July from a Soundgarden song, which is sort of ridiculous to even try on an acoustic. And I started to try to bang that out and sing it. It was, and then, you know, people usually will come up with just dumb ideas, like, you know, if it's an acoustic guitar, they'll be screaming Jesus Christ pose. And I don't know if you think they're funny or whatever, but it sounds a little like bluegrass, though, if you try to play it on
acoustic. I really think it's just people hoping. You know, maybe, please play that. And it's like, no,
they just want to hear it, and they think maybe you can make it sound like the record without any drums.
Virtually
or
impossible. Yeah,
you don't understand how hard that
you
is
cannot
to do, right?
Do that.
What kind of covers do you do, I guess, what I was asking, too?
Oh, I don't know anything I can think of. When I was in Jersey, I did a couple Springsteen songs. Mm-hmm. That went over good. It always does. You know, you're in Jersey, you play Springsteen, it works.
Yeah, you're pretty safe. Yeah. That's a safe bet with that one.
Do you remember seeing Anthony in California?
You're an ass.
I'm making sure he remembers.
Oh, at the hotel. Yeah,
at the Beverly Hills. That was good. You were getting your house painted.
That's right. No, I think my house flooded.
Oh, it was something. You were getting it fixed or something. Yeah. But it was kind of cool because like you know, everybody sees Chris on stage, fucking epitome of the rock star, and he's there, you know. Saying with his kids, like, hey, don't splash over there. It's like seeing the dad, Chris Cornell, was kind of an odd, out of place, but very cool thing. Because you came across, I don't know, you know, you could be the worst father in the world, but you came across as a great dad, like really attentive and stuff. But it was the weirdest thing to see in real life. It was completely out of context, you know. Hey, yeah, oh, yeah, look, he's swimming over there. They're riding on his back, and it's like, hey.
He's being a father.
Black Hole Sun guy.
Did the kids ask who he was? Like, who's the man with no shirt and a beer in each hand talking way too loud for this hotel?
All right, shut up. I do like that cabana service over there.
Yeah.
That is very, very nice. No, I read on something. Did you you stop drinking in like 2000 or something?
I think it was 2002.
Was there one of those big reasons, or just kind of a let me? You know.
I don't remember any of the reasons.
That's probably why.
About the five or six surrounding years, to be honest.
Oh, okay. maybe that.
But
was
I'm glad I stopped drinking. Like I feel like I get a lot more done.
Were you afraid creatively? Like,
no, I was never anyone that I could never write anything. Drunk or high on it, it never worked.
Really,
I would try, but it would be awful. Like especially if I wrote lyrics and then you know the next morning I would read it, I would immediately burn it. I didn't want anyone to ever even see it. I was horrible at that.
Because some people are really good at that, and then you know.
No, I've heard that story, but I remember I was in rehab, and there were people saying, so you know, it's going to be very difficult for you to transition into being creative when you're not loaded. And I said, no, not for me. Coffee was the only thing that ever worked for me, which still works.
Oh, for writing? Yeah.
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 Coffee rules.
When I would drink, I think creatively the best thing I could do was, you know, kind of get into those long, really bad blues jams that drunken guys get into. It's
never
the only
ends.
Time you can really put up with that and have the attention span for it, which is really depressing. So, that's all over.
Can you sit down and say, I'm going to write right now, I need to write, or does it just kind of like you wake up at 3 in the morning with lyrics or a
idea
riff?
Or something.
I think both those things happen. And probably to anybody that writes, anything, probably both those things happen. At some point, you'll end up in a position where you have to sit down and you have no ideas and you got to write something. It's like, God, I told these people this would be ready, you know? And
oh, like a deadline or something. That's got to be a little bit of pressure,
you know,
yeah.
Like in a, with a band, like working with Soundgarden, there's a lot of co-writing scenarios where, you know, I'm going to take your song home and work on it and then come back and we'll have something. And you know, you can't necessarily wait for lightning to strike. I always feel like that's the best way to go, though. Just wait around until I just
until something. Yeah. Yeah. With the Keeper, was that written specifically for the movie?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What's the movie? Machine Gun Preacher.
Machine Gun Preacher. Yeah.
Machine Gun Preacher. So, do you find that harder to write something on a subject like, here's a movie? Hey, write this, because like I told you last time you were on the Casino Royale. Opening theme is fantastic. I love it as just a regular song, not even as a movie theme.
Well, thank you.
Is it harder to say, hey, here's a movie, here's what the movie's about, or?
Well, I guess, you know, with an entire film, you know, and a script and a story, like, something like The Keeper, where it's based on the Machine Gun Preacher, who's a real guy, and it's his real life, and the scope of his life is really crazy, and, you know, he's like, he goes from meth head biker to born again Christian to guy that builds an orphanage in like a demilitarized zone in South Sudan, and he likes to shoot people, but he's a humanitarian, and like there's a lot to go on to write a song.
Yeah,
with that,
that's kind of true. Yeah, a lot of material there.
But it's also not like it's for a film. It's a collaboration with people making a movie and a screenwriter, and so that I can't just do whatever I want in a
so
sense.
They do have input
fit
on the song itself.
Well, I get pretty lucky most of the time when I've been in situations like that.
I'm good enough.
They
to,
just like it.
Yeah, yeah. They just like it.
Well, I've also had the other where I'm not sure if that works. Or I'm not sure if we like it, but usually things just go well.
Yeah.
I think if you try,
give it a whirl.
Yeah, just try to do a good job, and it usually works out.
Do they tell you if they want it to be acoustic or heavy, or they just kind of leave all that up to you?
Pretty much left all that up to me on this. And with Machine Gun Preacher, it was hard because there's sort of like this period of earlier in his life that's kind of like maybe biker rock 70s, and then there. I could have approached it from a gospel-oriented thing when he's sort of becoming this preacher, but then there's African music, Sudanese choir, there's hip hop, and there's all these different periods in the story where different kinds of music could fit in, and somehow or another, I ended up with just a acoustic guitar and singing. I'm not really sure how that.
You look at everything and go, "It's just too much shit here. Let me grab a guitar."
Are you actually singing the movie plot, or no? You're not singing about them. Are you singing something that fits it thematically, or actually what goes on in the movie?
Yeah, my approach was like because you know I don't know what it's like to be one of the children that the story's about, or the Sam Childers, and you know I'm not him, so I didn't have those experiences. So I ended up kind of approaching it like, what if Sam Childers were Woody Guthrie and he was writing a song about this situation and the plight of these kids and his dedication to risking his life to just make sure they're safe? And that's where the idea came from.
Yeah, because that to me is the hard part, is capture. Because I know I would just, I'm not a songwriter, but I know I would just write like scene by scene and just, you know.
Your song
make
it all hacky and
then the man
stupid.
Got on the plane, you know. I would just
your song would be literal. 90 minutes long.
It would be
literal dialogue from the movie. Right. Yes, every just single.
And he ducked in. I thought he was shot, but he was fine. It would be like, this stinks.
You were I guess a big part of the Pearl Jam movie.
He's in the documentary.
Out,
yeah.
In the documentary,
yeah, Cameron Crowe film,
yeah, which, about
which
Pearl Jam
was great. He did an amazing job, and it's a great documentary for fans because I feel like you really kind of get to see behind the curtain a little bit, and everybody's personality comes across very genuine, and then it's a Cameron Crowe film, which he's a guy that was a music journalist from the time he was, I don't know, 15
yeah,
or 14.
Kid.
And then, so he was interviewing Led Zeppelin when he was 15, and then he became an accomplished movie maker. So you put those two things together, and it's really an entertaining film. It's great.
Yeah, our own Travis here is a giant Pearl Jam fan, so he won't shut the fuck up about it.
Got a lot of Pearl Jam fans here.
No, I know. It's
I fucking love Pearl Jam.
It's amazing.
I can't wait to see this thing.
You should actually show Chris the Mexican guy or the Chilean guy.
Did you see the Chilean guy yet?
Have you seen this Chilean guy that sings?
Someone get on the. It's really quick. Uh-uh. He does Yellow Ledbetter.
Where the hell? Really? Travis.
Gotta,
I thought I saw Travis.
Even for 30 seconds, you got to see
it. It's ridiculous.
It's a show called.
My name is, but it's in.
Mi nombre es.
Yeah, mi nombre es out of Chile.
Out of Chile.
And they get these people and they dress up. As much as they can, as somebody, a singer, and they get up and sing as best they can in the style of, and most of them are pretty goofy and say they can't speak English, so they're just speaking phonetically.
Bunch of them are they're off. You could tell.
And this guy's like, "Mi llama es Eddie Vedder,"
right?
And he starts singing, and I was like, at first, I swear to you, I was like, "No, this
Where's
is bullshit."
The goof? They fucking
they like overdub this thing on here. Here he is.
Javier Diaz.
You got headphones? He needs some ears.
Mi nombre es Eddie Vedder.
Eddie Vedder.
Oh, it's like a sort of a contest, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's one of these kind of game shows. Vamos.
I thought he was lying.
Oh, my God, that's pretty amazing.
I swear, I thought they were...
And they're sitting listening and getting ready to judge it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That would be worth doing at an actual Pearl Jam show just for a minute.
Yeah, yeah, I know, right?
Come out and just see everybody look confused and upset.
And upset. Yeah. And upset. The guy is doing an amazing job.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy.
And this is what they'll do. If Eddie Vedder leaves Pearl Jam, they'll just fucking cart this guy out the way they did in Journey.
Like Journey. Yeah, you can hit it.
Yeah, so.
That's just...
Isn't that wild?
When I first saw it, I was like, come on. They friggin'...
They overdubbed
something. Some goofy guy found this show clip and popped friggin' Pearl Jam on top of it.
You ever find anyone that does you real well, Chris?
No, you know, I've had people send me stuff.
Hey, Chris, I sound just like you. Yeah, check it out.
Do you?
There'll be like just a moment, you know, where I kind of hear it, but most of the time I don't. Mm-hmm. I don't hear it.
Well, over the years, you got to realize, you know, without the pat on your own back, that you got a pretty good voice, good range.
I think I do a lot of stuff, so it's hard. I remember Timmy C from Rage used to say that he didn't really know where home base was for my voice. Like, there's no real.
Yeah, like if you're writing,
that's what he does all the time.
Yeah. Or if you're writing for your range,
kind of. And that I think that comes from songwriting. Whatever it is, I just kind of want to hear the singer that's going to sound right, you know. And so I never paid much attention to range.
Yeah,
it would be like, oh, I want to hear that melody, and it would be whatever key the song was in, and then that would just be it.
So many singers want to like. Punch you in the face right now that you just say that like I never thought about range.
Right.
Like some people are just really like I'd love key, to be able to hit that note, and it's just like nah, he could just hit it.
Not from that. There's on the job training, like the several years of you know, like the early years of Soundgarden. We joined started in 1984.
Jesus.
So it was a while of really being in a band and playing shows and doing it. I had very little range when I started.
Really?
Yeah.
You were able to crank
Holy
it up.
Shit.
Man, that is amazing. And then over the years, how do you take care of it? Do you have to?
Well, it helps not to drink and smoke.
Oh, well.
That makes it easier.
Does it?
Other than that, yeah. It's all the obvious things, really.
It's just the obvious things, you know. You can't drink like a fish, smoke cigarettes or weed or.
Yeah, and you can a little bit, but like a lot doesn't work.
Yeah,
but for much really. I mean, there's not a whole lot you can do. You can shoot pool or play shuffleboard. You can get those things done.
Do a lot of sports.
when you're in a band and you're out doing solo stuff, do other band members get resentful? Like whoever's out doing the solo stuff, whether it's the singer or the guitarist, do they start to feel like almost like you're leaving the relationship to do this?
Well, with Soundgarden, everybody always did stuff. I mean, Matt and I did Temple of the Dog in 1990, and you know that I think that was sort of a testament to just the trust that we had inside of the band, that it's okay to go out and do other stuff, And know that you're kind of safe in your band and everyone's secure in the fact that this is what everybody is dedicated to all the time.
Is there ever a time where the band wants to do something, but you're like, oh, I know the solo stuff's booked. I can't.
Not really.
You try to work it out. Right?
Not really. I think at this stage of being in Soundgarden, it's kind of good that everybody's doing other things because
a break is healthy, I would assume.
Well, I like to be really, really, really busy, and I think that to have that all sort of fall on the shoulders of Soundgarden probably isn't that great of a thing. I think for us to be able to do what we do with a more relaxed pace and not have like 2-year projections of what our schedule is going to be and release dates before we've written any songs for a record, that never really worked for us.
Why didn't you guys go back to the Temple of the Dog thing? Why didn't you go back to the Temple of the Dog thing? It was 1990, and you guys had some magic there. Another album or something.
We were in separate bands that were really busy.
Yeah. You know? but there was never time in the last, it's been 20 years now to get back and try to do something else with that.
I don't know, maybe because of the fact that it was something
for Andrew.
It took a couple of weeks to do it, and then it was very special, and it surrounded kind of a subject that was sort of important to us, being that it was a tribute to our friend that died, and I'm not sure if necessarily would have felt natural to like at least to go back and write other songs or record it. It would be fun to play shows or something and play the songs more.
Yeah,
because we've only done it every 6 years or so. Somehow something will happen when we get together and play.
Have you noticed a big change in personality wise? Because you guys were kids when Soundgarden originally, and now you're men, guys. Have you noticed huge personality changes in some of the guys where you're like, wow, that guy's really changed?
I feel like with everybody, even other guys in Seattle bands that I grew up with, everybody's pretty similar to the way they always were. I just sort of see everyone being a little less goofy and having more patience, I think.
That's just growing up. Anybody, doesn't necessarily have to do with where you're from.
I think doing solo stuff too. It's like it's got to be resentful when there's 4 people creatively collaborating. Or 5 people. How many? It's got to be annoying to have someone's ideas always overriding yours, or the one guy with the shit idea that everybody has to politely listen to. At least you can go out and do it, and it gets it out of the system. So there's no one just resenting the fact that their ideas can't be, made real or brought to fruition, as we say.
Well, I think that. That's sort of where side projects from bands usually come, because the people, it's not always going to make sense that something one guy in a band's going to want to do doesn't work for the band. And maybe it just, there's a lot of things I've done since the beginning of Soundgarden that didn't necessarily make sense for Soundgarden. It wouldn't fit. And I think that's where those side projects come from most of the time with any band.
You had a great song on, I don't remember the name of the song, but it was on Slash's record, which was really good.
Yeah, that was fun.
Oh, fuck yeah.
Yeah, that was an amazing album. Did you write that, or did he write that and just ask you to come in for it?
He wrote the guitar parts, and I just kind of took that and wrote to it, really, and responded with emails of MP3s.
Oh, God, just back and forth.
We were in the studio the day that I came in to sing it, and it was it was the final version of the music, but initially it was just the demo that he sent me via email, and then I recorded over it and sent it via email back, which is weird, but,
the future.
Strangely, it works.
What do you do? How do you tell somebody if they're sending you ideas that are just atrocious? Like, even if it's a guy you respect and he's like, sitting, oh, no, maybe you should sing this, and you're like, ugh.
You go dark for a really, really unreasonably long time.
Send him back corrupted files. I'm trying.
Yeah, I don't know what happened.
Yeah, you get emails that are just question marks, like, where are you?
Right.
And just ignore it.
Yeah, you don't actually say, like, that was hard. You just actually come back with something that's better and just go, no, here's what I got. I didn't see that.
No, you just ignore it.
just ignore it.
Yeah.
Yeah. When you write so much, you've written a lot of songs. Do you start feeling like have you ever written anything where you've looked at and gone, hey, wait a minute, I've done that before. God. I guess you don't want to be redundant.
Actually done stuff twice where I'll realize this was an idea I already had and maybe I just didn't record it. But what's way worse than that is I'll get some melody in my head and think that it's really great. And then realize it's someone else's song.
Yeah.
Exactly.
To a T.
Sounds good for a minute, right? And the only all the glitters is gold. I've heard that.
This is really hooking.
It's like,
oh,
the Beatles did this.
This is so catchy. Yeah. I love it.
Something
it's
about
be great.
It. I don't know what. It's like as though I've heard it before. Oh,
yeah.
Shit,
guys, I got it. I saw her standing there.
Yeah. Like a virgin.
Yeah.
I don't know why I like that. It's. I think it's a great idea. I think it might go over big with the kids.
Will you just scrap the idea, or will you like go, all right, because maybe you add a little bit to it and you don't realize that you got the basic foundation from somewhere else. Will you scrap the whole idea and just go, fuck it, I can't, or will you just build
on
it?
If it is exactly something else. I think like a lot of the time you can play me in kind of any song and I might be able to tell you two or three things that have similar notes or similar.
Right.
But if that happens, that's okay. But if it's just one thing, you know, it's kind of a carbon copy of somebody else's song.
Yeah.
And it happens.
It's amazing how it goes. Sorry.
Yeah, I haven't really heard Soundgarden, at least, be guilty of something like that. Some of the
quality
band.
Control in place.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not going to get to you.
Yeah, yeah.
Somebody's going to say, that sounds exactly like blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, the song's never going to make the show.
They're like, no way. You play it and go, shit, it is.
Yeah, the song's not going to make the album.
So you got to have people like that around you, though. Like Lady Gaga, who I like, got a lot of shit because that one song sounded like Madonna, a lot like Madonna. Mm-hmm. And nobody around her probably, because she's solo, said to her, you can't do that. It sounds just like, you know, Madonna in a band. At least you can call each other out and go, what the fuck are you doing?
What are you doing?
That's true. That's what's great about a band. There's, that's why... That's what creates the identity of the band. That's what sort of serves the fans. You know, you can't take hard right turns if you're in a band that's truly democratic. You know, you can't go hard to the right or hard to the left because you've got a bureaucracy that is going to sort of slow that down at least a little bit.
Would you guys ever work with Black Sabbath? Like on the road or something?
That'd be great.
Cool.
Obviously, I played a show with Black Sabbath in Germany, and it was unbelievable. I guess that would have been like 5 years ago.
Was it Ozfest?
No, it was just like a German festival.
Oh,
and we played, and then they came out, and it was really incredible. I was blown away. Everybody was great. The only thing that was a little weird was the drummer had an actual guy crouched down beside the hi-hat using his fingers to count off measures and beats. To the guy, so it would be sort of one, two, and then two, so he always kind of knew where he was. And didn't really look at the guy, but the guy was there in case he needed to look at the guy.
That's really odd.
I think Bill Ward's Bill Ward. I wonder if his hearing is going a little bit.
I don't know.
Play with a click or something.
Maybe he just got lost. I mean, it can happen, I guess, over time where you sort of...
Wow.
Your mind can wander, but he didn't... He never seemed to need it, but the guy was there for him.
I don't understand what that one, two, three... Like, how would that help during a song? I mean, I'm not musically inclined.
If you get lost in the song, I would rather you could just look down and
measure is. I don't
keep
know.
The beat to the guy's fingers, and you'd, regardless of what you're hearing, you know you're on.
You're doing your part.
They were so good. It was really incredible. I mean, that's when you stop and go, that's how you do it. That's how the real guys... do it.
Have you noticed Ozzy's voice sounds a lot better now? It's weird. I think he quit drinking. He sounds like a lot healthier now than he did 5 years ago.
Something about that. I don't know. Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
if you pause and like look at certain things, I don't know. I always felt like he was just sort of uniquely him. So I've always liked his voice live. I always felt like he did a great job.
Yeah. Even when it cracks, it's still fun.
Yeah, exactly.
He's still Ozzy. Yeah.
He forgets the fucking worst Over the Mountain 30 seconds into the show. Who cares? Still great. He would do that. He would just start singing the last verse first, and nobody gave a shit. It just worked.
Chris,
great.
Thanks, man.
Thank you.
Always a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Opie Radio podcast. Hear Opie Radio weekdays at 3 p.m. Eastern. And download the SiriusXM app to find shows on demand.